Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the closing session of the third annual Fundraising Success Virtual Conference and Expo. I'm Margaret Battistelli-Gardner, Editor-in-Chief of Fundraising Success. I'm really looking forward to this session because, well, one, it's the end of the day, and I get to turn over the moderating duties to someone else. And more importantly, it's a chance to listen in as some of our editorial advisory board members talk about the important issues and toughest challenges facing fundraisers today. Before we get started, let me point out a few quick tips on how to make the most of today's live session. First, if you have any technical difficulties, troubleshoot by clicking on the Help widget at the bottom of the console marked with a question mark, or let us know via the Q&A box. You can also use the Q&A box to submit your questions to today's panelists. We'll be addressing select questions at the end of the session and also throughout the session. You can send them in at any time. Please make sure you turn off any pop-up blockers on your computer so that you can utilize all of the widgets on the console. To figure out what all those widgets do, please click on the Tips for Attendees widget below to learn how you can customize your experience today. You can even tweet right from the console. Also, as you probably know, each of the sessions in today's conference are eligible for CFRE credits. The tracker document required to apply for the credit for this session can be downloaded via the Resource widget on the console. Lastly, if you leave the session at any time or you'd like to view it again later, access the entire presentation from the auditorium in the FSV on-demand environment, which will be open for 3 months beginning on Monday, October 15th. So let's get into our session. Please welcome our panel moderators, Dane Grams, Director of Nonprofit Services and Business Development at CARE2, and also co-chair of the FS Advisory Board, and his co-chair and co-moderator for today, Joe Sullivan, who's just now finishing up a contract with a UN organization in the D.C. area and looking forward to her next venture in the nonprofit world. Dane and Joe will spend the next 45 minutes corralling cats while actually moderating our panel, which consists of Mark Pittman, founder of the Fundraising Coach, and who you may also recognize as Fundraising's bow tie guy, Tom Harrison, CEO of Russ Reed, who, as far as I know, does not wear a bow tie, Christina Johns, director of new media at International Fellowship of Christians and Jews, and Jeff Jowdy, founder and president of Lighthouse Council. Fundraising and direct mail guru Roger Craver was supposed to be here as well, but he had to cancel because of illness, so we wish him a quick recovery. Joe and Dane, why don't you explain how we'll be handling the panel today, and good luck with that.
Great. Thanks a lot, Margaret. I'm thrilled to be in the midst of such a distinguished and very funny panel. It's a pleasure to be moderating today with the lovely and talented Joe Sullivan, with whom I've had the pleasure of working with for many years. I know you can't see her, but she looks fantastic. I can't either. I just know it.
I paid him well for that comment.
So the way today's panel is going to work is that each of our fundraising experts will throw out a hot topic, and then each of the panelists will have an opportunity to respond and offer their insight on that particular issue. Today's conversation is completely unscripted. We expect it to be informative, lively, and lots of fun. We will also have room for audience issues or questions like Margaret mentioned, so please feel free to send them our way. Alrighty, let's kick things off with Mr. Tom Harrison and his first hot topic. Tom, take it away.
Thank you to Dane Grams and Katy Perry, our two co-moderators, for kicking things off so nicely. So if we're looking at the most pressing problems, the toughest challenges facing the nonprofit world today, we could talk about watchdogs. We could talk about the threat to charitable tax deductibility. We could talk about the post office. But I want to talk about something that's not inflicted on us from the outside. I want to talk about something that's self-inflicted by our nonprofits. And that is the misuse of branding. So let me start with the premise. People can't give to you if they don't know you're there. And they won't give to you until they're persuaded of the importance of your work. So right there, I'm saying branding is really important for all nonprofits. There's a solid business case. We have to have strong branding. You got to build awareness. You got to build positioning. And you got to create an environment in which your fundraising is going to work. But I would like to suggest that, by definition, successful branding for a nonprofit must support fundraising, or it isn't successful branding at all. And what we're seeing increasingly at large and small nonprofits across the country, we could give too many painful examples, is that branding sometimes supports program and conflicts with fundraising. For example, if a rescue mission's branding focuses on giving hope to the poor instead of feeding hungry people, Or if a wildlife group's branding focuses on the science of global warming instead of saving fuzzy animals. Donors care about those things, they just don't care enough to give. And so what happens is your branding is undermining your fundraising. And if your organization's brand undermines your fundraising messages, you got to change your branding. Otherwise, you'll have great awareness of a bankrupt organization. So I think that the value proposition of nonprofits is the opportunity that we offer donors to address urgent, unmet needs, saving lives, saving animals, feeding children, changing the world for the good. And if nonprofit branding powerfully communicates that value proposition, it supports fundraising and it's a glad thing. However, when nonprofit branding reflects the programmatic identity of an organization apart from the donor interaction, it can really take away from the fundraising. Anybody agree with that?
Thanks, Tom. Very well said. And I'd love to hear from our panelists their thoughts or feelings around branding. Christina?
I'm going to jump in. I think that that's absolutely right. I think that you just have to be, in terms of branding, making sure you have to prioritize. A lot of organizations, especially in their missions, they have several different objectives that they're trying to accomplish. One might be education, one might be humanitarian aid, and they all fall under, you know, they all fall within the mission. So I think a really strong communication strategy has to be in place so that everyone in the organization knows exactly what they're focusing on when it comes to branding and what points are taking priority within their own mission statement.
Great. Jeff?
Absolutely. Great points. One of the important things from what we encounter is just the coordination of the communication, marketing, branding functions, and we certainly see greater success when there's a advancement model where it's all under one umbrella. It's more of a challenge with the mixed messages, as Tom shared, if those functions are differently, and they're oftentimes, unfortunately, competing within the organization. So it's essential to be in sync and to have the right messages, the right audience, the right time, that they're coordinated. Some of that can be best achieved with you got to have systems in place and structure so that everybody is on the same page and in sync.
Can I just cut in on this, too? This is Tom again. I can't prove this, but I sometimes suspect that there are some people at nonprofits who secretly feel, I don't know, contemptuous of fundraising. And so brand marketing can seem like a high-minded departure from that tawdry, icky business of asking for money. And I think that's lamentable. I mean, truly,
Amen.
Charitable giving is one of the purest social, almost spiritual acts that a person mm-hmm. can perform. And if we facilitate charitable giving, that's an admirable calling. I think it's up to us to change the mindset among program people, board members, management, and others so that they value effective fundraising, because they see it helps the organization grow, but also because they see it has a positive impact on the donor.
Tom, do you think that's why we're seeing more and more organizations combine communications departments with development departments? I feel like I've seen some of the strongest branding and best brand representation when organizations are really operating from one communications and development department.
You're absolutely right. And when those are unified, it makes it much stronger for the organization. What's happening is we're increasingly seeing for-profit brand experts come to the nonprofit world, and they live in an environment where you wake up in the morning and you need soap, so you go to the store and you buy soap. And when you're choosing, you're impacted by all the brand messages. No one wakes up in the morning saying, I have to give my money away today. And so if you just do pure branding, without tying it to the urgent call and the way you can make a difference and have significance in your life, then you're going to end up in trouble because you're going to not have any money.
Right.
So this is Joe.
Any other thoughts, Mark?
Oh, yeah, Mark, and then
go.
I have a comment. But no, that's okay, Mark. You are in line
yeah,
Mark. Next.
Oh, yeah.
You're in line
oh, yeah,
next, Mark,
guy.
And then I'll go and then I'll move on to Christina. Oh, sorry. You called me blonde earlier. Now you're paid.
I didn't. I called me. Whatever. Okay, we won't go there, but I'm sure we'll be gleeful about that.
Nice.
I think that I was having did you like that little glee comment?
I did.
I was having sort of a religious experience listening to Tom because I hadn't really seen branding as that I love the idea of keeping branding, incorporating fundraising. I think it's Tom Ahern that first told me that if your mission is dependent on donors, you need to make donors part of your mission. If you don't survive without donations, then donors need to be, by virtue of their importance, part of your overall nonprofit mission. And I like the idea of you incorporating your branding that way. It changes the whole way you focus on your messaging, like Tom was saying. So, Tom, I was just like having a revival experience here in my office. That was great. Thanks.
Great.
Okay,
Joe, Katy Perry.
Yes, I do have one quick thought. And then we did have a question about branding that, Tom, you may want to hit too. But I'm going to make the blasphemous comment that I think for most charities that have a large mass marketing fundraising program, that is your branding program. And I think Tom is absolutely right. Sometimes fundraising or mass marketing becomes a four-letter word. I remember in one of my early jobs, someone introduced me as the woman who was taking over the direct mail department. You know that junk mail stuff. So if you want your name off the list, you go to her. And that was an HR person from the organization. And I think what everyone finds out is that we put way too much thought and stock in organizations that are large, already seasoned, and already have a great place and a great recognition in what their brand is. I'll actually use one of Russ Reed's clients in a group that I absolutely admire, and that's Operation Smile. Their brand is that they do surgeries for children with cleft palates around the world, and it's their basis for fundraising. Fundraising came first. It came fabulously. It's a very simple, clear message with a call to action, but it's also their brand, and there's no need to come in and try to change that or mess with it in organizations that your mass marketing program is your brand. We did have one question that, Tom, I don't know if you or Dane or somebody want to grab, and that's really just explain branding, and I think that is a fantastic question because for the consumer packaged goods people, as Tom indicated, they get it. They live and breathe it. So maybe, Tom, do you want to hit what you interpret branding maybe in the context of the for-profit and the not-for-profit world is?
Sure, Joe. And I don't have a business school definition of brand. I wish I had one in front of me, so I'm going to just kind of make this up. Branding is the experience that someone has, a constituent has with your organization. So it's how you communicate to them and listen to them and the entire experience of it. So if you know Nordstrom has a brand based on customer service. Everybody's got a story about Nordstrom and how they got taken care of very well with it. So it may be with a rescue mission that their brand is all about helping the least, the last, and the lost. Downtrodden people. Or World Vision's brand might be, how do we do sustainable community development through children, through child sponsorship? And so every organization can kind of encapsulate who they are and what they do, but it's risky because sometimes you'll pick what you do instead of what you want your donor to support. You'll pick your success instead of your need. And if you do that, you can't raise money.
Okay. Any other questions around branding? I don't see the Q&A tab.
I do.
Up.
Could I?
Please.
Is it okay for me? Okay. This is Mark. Tom.
No,
We know about you, Mark. No way. How do you do that in a way that doesn't? The example that's sticking out for what you said was, we feed hungry people versus we give the hope to the poor. Are there ways to – have you found ways that organizations are good at doing – accentuating the need without demeaning the people that their services are being provided to?
Yeah, absolutely. And I can give you an example of where it didn't work, and let's try to talk together about where it does. United Cerebral Palsy was doing a television special to raise money. Halfway through the special, they said, you know, you can't make these people that we serve look like they, you know, need help. We want to show the dignity and the life and the worth and everything else of them. And we kind of said, you know, if you don't want to show that they need help, you're going to put a TV show on there that's not going to raise any help because you've convinced the people they don't need help. And so you got to use different vehicles like newsletters, magazines, presentations, different vehicles where you can talk about all aspects of what you do. But when you're talking to an audience of donors, you got to make sure that you're always underscoring, we're making progress, tell a little success story, and the need is still great. you're part of something that's working, and the need is still great. It's a 1-2 punch, and you always got to show their success. You're investing in success, and the need is still great. And when you forget about the need because you're talking about how well things are going, that's when you get in trouble.
Thanks.
Well said. Okay, I want to make sure, I think Dane and I kind of had a commitment that each person gets two topics in the brief amount of time we have left. So if you have follow-up questions to any of these, feel free to email your hosts today at Fundraising Success Magazine, and they can dissipate those, or disseminate, not dissipate, those through the experts here, and we can get back to you. I know, that was a great word, right? So, Christina, let's move on to you. Christina, the Director of New Media for International Fellowship of Christians and Jews, as you can see by her bio. What is your topic for us today? And then I think we'll just go Jeff, Mark, Tom, and if Dane and I have any commentary, we'll just kind of go around the circle, if that's all right.
Sure. Well, one of the things that I wanted to, you know, bring up that I think is going to be pretty important here is the need and expectation for total transparency and access to nonprofits in the future. So basically what I'm saying is that there seems to be some, especially with the newer organizations, like if you take Charity Water, for example, like they have a really strong base of ways that their donors or supporters can interact with the organization, and they're very clear on what they do and where the money goes. And while it might be the model might be easier and work well for Charity Water, I'm wondering how other nonprofits that have a more complicated model will be able to mirror that same type of transparency and that same type of access.
That's a really good point. It's something I know we all struggle with. So, Jeff, do you want to talk about what you're sort of seeing in the industry? And then, again, we'll just hit Mark and Tom. Maybe you can talk about a couple of your clients.
Absolutely. I think it's, you know, transparency really goes to something that's that always resonates, and those of us in the fundraising world, that's ethics and how you present yourself, and are you congruent with who you say you are and what you do with reality. And certainly on a number of levels, and with the mass media marketing, internet web, it's having giving donors access to information about you, and of course the 990 required, and even beyond that, planning processes, being transparent where you're headed. And then at another level, really, that oftentimes is an issue and resonates is in the nonprofit world, so many is compensation. Gave a talk a couple of weeks ago to Rotary Club about one topic, and all the questions were on ethics and compensation in nonprofits because of one or two poor examples they had seen with board not paying attention and a CEO gone wild, so to speak. So certainly by being transparent at several levels and in communicating, but it also resonates the responsibility of the board to be the watchdog.
I totally agree. Is it all right if I just jump in? Because I just did.
Yep, that's absolutely. I was going to introduce you, but then I thought we're smart enough. We'll just go one after the other. That worked.
Yay, cool. I couldn't agree more about transparency. I've been working with an organization that works with homeless veterans, and it's been scary to see the dogged determination CNN reporters are having at going over, and there's some odd charity watchdog site. And if you're on the call, I'm sorry, but get someone to design it for you because it just doesn't look good. That's going on getting 990s and then doing the math on the 990s without any narrative storytelling. And so what you get is a snapshot of fundraising expenses that may be unethical and inappropriate, but they may be part of a bigger picture. The analogy I like to use is that when I've been told, I haven't seen this, when a python eats a pig, it expands and it looks a lot like a pig for a while until it digests it. And so I call it the pig and the python. Sometimes your fundraising expenses may be that pig and the python where you're still the python. You just took on a bigger chunk to then be able to do more in the future. So some transparency things that I think are really important is I think every nonprofit should put their 990 on their website in their About You section. Very few people are probably going to look at it, but it's public data anyway. So it's not serving you by not having it accessible from your website. And then the other thing is having the key people that will talk to media and maybe other people too ready to tell the narrative. Okay, these are the numbers. Why are they this way? Why did you just spend $80 million on direct mail fundraising? Is it because you make really weird decisions on your fundraising goals, or is it because you're doing something strategically for the next 3 years? And none of the organizations that have been the big exposés on TV have had have compellingly told that story. Of course, we're at the whim of media editors also. They may be cutting those good talking points out.
When I heard Christina talk about transparency, I wanted to stand up and applaud. You're really right on. And I think something that goes hand in hand with transparency is donor intent. And we don't always know donor intent exactly, but we have to put ourselves in the position of a normal, intelligent donor and think, what would they want to know? What would they want to give to? Well, let's not put it in the fine print. Let's just be straightforward to people. And I think that despite the self-appointed, self-anointed watchdogs and the puppies in the media that are following them, it's up to us. No offense against puppies, Joe. I know you take that seriously. But it's up to us to educate the public better. First, it takes money to manage an organization, a complicated organization that's tackling cancer or poverty. Otherwise, it'd be easy. It takes money to raise money for it, and we need to explain that far better than we ever have. And we also need to encourage people to judge the impact of the organization. I know lots of nonprofits with low fundraising costs that aren't doing anything. And I know other nonprofits with high fundraising costs that are making a life-changing and saving difference in the world. And it's incumbent on us to tell the story better.
Wow, passionately well put, and couldn't agree more. Any other thoughts before we move on?
I think another
Joe,
point.
I just wanted to say, as a former development staff person at both a small organization and a large organization, I couldn't agree more with Tom's statement. One organization that I worked with invested heavily in acquisition over the years. They didn't become beholden to the online watchdogs, and they were making a long-term commitment to grow the organization. And today, you know, they're a $40 million powerhouse with a building in Washington, D.C. The other organization, you know, strictly held to sort of online fundraising standards, and because of it, we were never really able to grow because there was no long-term investment in fundraising and increasing the size of the organization. So,
I also think that just sort of ties back to branding, too. It's all one, really. If you're out there doing really, really great things and you are meaningfully changing the fate of whomever it is you serve and you're telling people openly and honestly, then the charity watchdog groups who shall remain nameless, they have less and less power. You're taking the power away from them by being honest, upfront, and using the dollars well.
That's right.
And
exactly.
And I think you could also be I think that you can also be creative with this information, like beyond like having it on your 990. I mean, there are some organizations that are being really forward-thinking with their with being transparent and using it as part of storytelling with infographics and things like that. So I think that's also something we can keep in mind, too, as time goes on.
I think a part of transparency, too, is just allowing the donors to have a dialogue with you. So beyond the watchdogs, sometimes you'll go on a website, and it's easy to give, but it's hard to dialogue and communicate and ask a question to find out who to talk with.
Very true.
Well, I'm going to move us along to the next topic now. And, Jeff, this is one of my favorite topics. I know firsthand what an engaged board can do for an organization. So I'd like for you to talk a little bit about your hot topic, which is board engagement.
Well, it's inevitable for I don't know how many years, every time we work with a client, that what the project, what the scope is, that somehow the board becomes the number one either opportunity or challenge. And usually about a week or two into working with the CEO, either they're bragging about the board or that door closes slowly and their eyes roll back and they start talking about their job search. It's been said that you get the board you deserve, but it is the number one. It's the fiduciary. It's the boss of boss, whether it be the CEO or the consultant, the hired gun. And having the right board engaged in the right ways, we find just consistently is the number one overall ingredient to success for a nonprofit. So from selecting the right board, orienting them, evaluating them, the whole board cycle, to the ongoing investment it takes, and it does take a lot of investment to have a stellar board, to giving them the comfort and success in being ambassadors and fundraisers, and then finally, you know, to that relationship building, because they are the key leaders of the organization. They're who you want to call and have them call you back right away, and that boils down to their passion for the mission as well as their connectedness to the key staff of the organization, because we can respond to who we enjoy working with. So just over and over, either the great exhilaration of success or the great pain of the team that we work with, it ends up being rooted in the board.
And what is the formula for that successful relationship to really have that level of commitment and engagement? What can we do as fundraisers to make sure that happens?
This is Mark. One of the things that I love to do for boards is give them permission to be smart. I think a lot of board members, they don't realize that we target them because they have great skill sets in different areas in their life. They get into this room, and I've done this myself on the boards I sit on. So when I'm talking with the board, I say, don't we do this? We have these experiences. We have this success in life. We get invited onto a board doing something that we really don't know we care about, but we don't know the mechanics of how to do healthcare or feed the poor or whatever. So we walk into the room. We take all of our worldly wisdom, that hat, we put it on a hat rack, sit around a table, make a bunch of really stupid decisions, and then we get off and put our worldly hat on, you know, our wisdom hat on, and stuff that we would never do to our business, we do to these nonprofits. Some guy started a school because he wanted to give a certain type of education. Realized 3 years into it, he didn't want to fund the entire school, and he didn't have an exit strategy, but he ran car dealerships. He would never have entered the car dealership business without having an exit strategy on mitigating his losses and what are the other things he's going to do. So I think encouraging board members, and that can be scary because they start asking questions, and but I think it makes for a much stronger organization when people – for one quick example, so somebody else can speak, but I was working at a hospital. I was a one-person fundraising shop at a hospital. I had a financial planner on my board look at me and say, are 17,000 people in our daily database get the same exact direct mail letter? I said, well, yes, they do. He said, I'd go out of business if I did that. I need to know that my target, and he started defining his target market for his business, and he said, why don't we segment? And it was just, it was like I fed him a script as a fundraiser. I wanted to segment. I wanted to do some research on my database. And so with him saying that, all the other people around the board realized, oh, yeah, we would never do that in our business. We know our customers. We do some research. Yeah, let's fund research for this organization too.
Great. Christina, any thoughts?
No, I completely agree with that. I mean, you have to really open it up and put the opportunity out there because, you know, a lot of people that are on boards may or may not have, you know, expertise, you know, specifically in the nonprofit world, and they might feel uncomfortable. And when the questions are posed to them in a way that they allows them to, you know, use their life experience and relate to the organization, which obviously they care greatly about, you're able to pull different perspectives in that you might or might not have seen otherwise.
Tom, any other thoughts?
You can't blame the board members because they tend to be successful, smart people who have learned throughout their career that they can trust their gut. And they use their gut every day in business. So they walk into an environment where they know absolutely nothing, including, you know, the surgical suite. And they're smart, successful, type A people who are going to say, well, I can figure this out. And they're going to just try it. And so you know you're going to be in a mess. And so I think to start with, if you can separate the difference between governance and management and have them involved in governance and not in management, you're always better off.
Mm. Great.
That's good.
Excellent.
Yeah.
And, you know, for me, my personal experience has been also to teach them to be fundraisers. I mean, these people have amazing networks, and we shouldn't be ashamed or embarrassed to ask them to ask for money. You know, Joe and I put a series of fundraising trainings on together for the board at my last organization, and every time we met, there was a fundraising component to that board meeting to give the board members the tools that they needed to go out there and represent the organization.
And they'll find that they have more fun than they expected, that if they get engaged that way. They become feeling like they're actually doing something for the organization, and it's something they care about with their friends. So it's not nearly as scary as they think it's going to be.
So I couldn't agree more. Go back to the theory of who these people are. They're successful people who are competitive and they like success. So if you can take them out and make them successful at an easy fundraising call, they're going to say, I'm doing that again. And you're going to turn them into successful fundraisers. Make it easy for them. And instead of being – then you give them a lot of affirmation at the board meeting, and the other board members are thinking, I want that affirmation too. Maybe I should do this.
Tom, it sounds like you're talking about all of us.
Yeah, really.
So why don't you take that cue and go on to our next topic?
Sure. My one caveat about board members is board members are people too. We forget a lot of times we are donors. We are board members. We are fundraisers. It's all one thing. We're really just people that want to change whatever the fate of whatever it is we believe wholly in, and we can wear whatever hats we want to wear. We're all the same person, so just find the right message for whomever you are. And, Mark, on to you. I won't even guess which topic you'd like to bring up first. It'll be a surprise for the group, so where do you want to take this?
As the fundraising coach, I need to say that one of the toughest challenges I think facing nonprofits is the not being clear on the ask. It seems to be a resurgence in the last 18 months of people, and I don't know if it was the perceived bad economy or what it was, but a lot of people seem to not want to put a dollar amount on major gift asks in front of people. They seem to – so this is my statement. If you say, would you support our cause, that's a cop-out. That's not a solicitation.
Ooh.
The person doesn't know what you expect from that. We had one savvy donor in a fundraising event in Maine here. We were going to be asking $25,000 for, but it was one of those deals where you get together, board member had a cocktail party, everybody showed up, no solicitation at the event, we'll follow up with you after the event. The next morning, we get a check for $250 in our inbox. We wrestled with this. That's $250. It was totally preemptive. They knew what they were doing. They're a $25,000 candidate. Can we, with a straight face, say, thank you so much for the check. We'd still like to visit and talk to you about a gift. Thanks for the gratuity for that tip and the hors d'oeuvre. That was wonderful that you paid the check. But we'd like to really talk to you about a charitable donation. So, it's what we've been talking about with transparency and branding and board members or people, too. It's out of respect for the other person. I've only had coffee spilled on me or spit out at me, and nobody's died at me when I've said a dollar amount. Hey, I'd like you to consider a gift of $150,000 over the next 3 years. I have gotten one person's coffee because it was just poorly timed on my part. It was a little higher than they were expecting. But most people tend to get flattered if you're asking them out, and at least you've done them the respect of knowing, of telling them what you're thinking. And if you don't know, it's really easy. Before I let Tom and others talk about this, if you don't know, all you can say is, hey, I have no idea what to ask you for, but this is the gift chart that we have. We really need someone at the $150,000 level. Is that something you could consider? And then I guess the important part after that is to shut up.
Oh,
and again,
amen.
It's out of respect. It's totally out of respect. It's not because you're going to win, lose, none of that. The other person needs to process what you've just requested, and they will let you know when they're done processing by being the first one to speak.
Okay, Tom,
beautiful.
That's your cue.
Yeah,
Tom.
Well, I was being quiet out of respect, which
I
so, rarely do. You're so right. I've seen people make the ask and then get so nervous in the silence that they start undercutting the ask. You know, well, and if that's too much, maybe we could talk to you about something else. And they negotiate with themselves instead of leaving the silence.
You know,
there.
I'm really sorry I even asked. I'm going to slink away from the table now and pretend I wasn't even here. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. No, you're exactly right. I think that's great. And I think that if we start with the premise that giving to a meaningful organization is something that's going to make a positive difference in the donor's life, then we should be proud to ask. And if we have board members who aren't proud to ask, maybe they shouldn't be board members. Or maybe if we've got management that's not proud to ask, maybe they shouldn't be with the organization if they're not that proud of the organization and the work that we do.
Preach it.
Christina, any thoughts from you?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Tom. I think that equipping either the manager or the major gift officer or whoever is, you know, making this ask, equipping them with not only the knowledge of what this, you know, this sum of money is going to do for the organization and being as specific as you can, but also equipping that person with the knowledge of the person that they're asking this money from. Like, what specifically interests that person? Is it a particular part of the mission? Is it one thing,
right.
You know, having as much information about that particular donor as possible before you go in there and make that ask.
Valid point. Jeff, we haven't heard from you yet.
Absolutely. Yeah, John Rockefeller shared that to look at a gift as you would a high-grade investment, and absolutely part of it is our helping to share the joy of giving and making a request, appropriate request from a position of strength and not begging. And doing it at the right time, being sure the donor is ready, and so that when he or she or they are doing that processing, it's an appropriate processing. And I can definitely relate to the silence. I was at independent school and would make calls with the head of school, and I would end up making the ask, and because she didn't feel comfortable doing that, and as soon as I did, she'd jump in, well, I know that's a lot of money, and it's probably too much. And we had about 20 debriefs or 30 probably over a couple of years, and I never could get her past that, so I just stopped bringing her.
It took you how many years to stop bringing her? It took you 2 years?
Oh, yeah. I was slow at processing that. She was my boss, so yeah.
Oh, ouch. Any other thoughts? I know we only have about 10 minutes left, and we have some really, really great topics. I'm going to throw this out to Dane on the fly. Sorry, Dane. Do you think we want to just kind of fast forward through our topics since we won't have time to go around to each person, probably not even one other topic, and everybody had some really good trends within the industry. So what do you think is a good way to get the trends out even if we don't have lots of discussion?
Let's keep going as sort of a lightning round and get people's reactions to things and move on. Let's move right to Tom and the pressure organizations are feeling to jump too quickly into the digital sphere.
So your board and your younger staff want you to switch 100% to digital because it's the future. And it likely is the future, but it doesn't give you the ROI that you need. So what do you do? And what we're seeing is nonprofits are bouncing between two extremes, online triumphalism in the face of all data to the contrary, and offline defensiveness. And these are the people who continually circulate studies about the dominance of direct mail, right, in your office. You've seen these people. So both sides are wrong because they are incorrectly assuming a binary relationship between online and offline. It's either one or the other. It used to be a single-channel response loop. I get mail. I write check, I send check back to you. And that still happens for all of us. We still see that with many, many of our donors. But gradually we're moving
check.
Yeah, that's right. Gradually we're moving into a multi-channel response loop that blends online and offline. And what we all have to do, and there have been a number of sessions during the conference today, we have to have multi-channel fundraising to meet the donors where they are. And all of it, whether it's direct mail, DRTV, radio, emails, banners, social campaigns, face-to-face, all of it's got to create urgent demand to meet a need and an easy-to-use avenue. And one of the key challenges that everybody's seeing in this is attribution. And it's so vital. We all have to get straight on this because if you air a DRTV show and people call in to an operator and make a pledge or give a credit card, nobody says, oh, my gosh, phones are working. We don't need TV anymore. Let's just hire more operators. Or nobody would do that. That's crazy talk, right? But you know what? You air a DRTV spot, people go online to give, and people say, whoa, the Internet is working. We don't need this TV and this mail anymore. And it's crazy. So we have to figure out how we go back and attribute what's the driver, what's causing people to give, and then what's the response vehicle. What's the vehicle they're using to give to? And you got to balance both of those to make sure you're continually driving the contribution and you're also giving them an easy way. So I would just say don't swing before the pitch. We got to keep testing our way into all media, and then it allows you to pull the levers so that you can decide. It's not about switching from one medium to another. It's about using all media and determining which ones are the most effective at driving, which ones are the most effective for response.
Amen. Nice. And I, for one, go and try on my sweaters at J. Crew before I order them online. So even as consumers, we use multiple channels before we make our decisions. So why do we think we wouldn't do that as donors? Okay, I'm done. Next.
Great
don't,
point.
Don't put your eggs in, all your eggs in one basket. I mean, the organizations that weathered the storm through the economic collapse and are doing the best now have a well-balanced portfolio.
Yep.
Cool.
Jeff, Mark, Christina, any thoughts from you guys?
I mean, you really hit it. I mean, being the director of new media, obviously, that's an area that is very close to me. No, I don't think direct mail is dead. Yes, I have a checkbook. Yes, you know, like, I mean, really, it's an old argument. No,
too.
Email's not dead, blah, blah, blah. So I think it's really, it's 100%, you know, actually looking at your data, looking at your house file, determining where the sources are, as Tom was referring to. Before I was director of new media, I was director of DRTV. So I could tell you that there's a vast difference between our constituents that are coming in through DRTV and the ones that are coming in online. However, after doing, like, some thorough analysis, we were able to tell that our most profitable donors are the ones that give both online and through the mail. So in that way,
right.
You just want to make sure that your messages are consistent and that and it goes back to the first point about branding. It's no matter whether it's on Facebook, on DRTV, a donor is to make someone want to give, the message has to be there and the confidence has to be there that this is, you know, this is something that's legitimate and verifiable, whether you're Googling them or what have you. But 100% with what Tom was saying.
Great. Great. And, Tom, great topic and great responses from everyone. We do have one question that has come in from an audience member. Sharon is asking, when interviewing to recruit board members, is there a list of skills or characteristics that you should consistently ask for? Jeff, do you want to take that?
I'm sorry.
When interviewing to recruit board members, is there a list of specific skills or characteristics that you should consistently ask for?
Yeah. Well, it's reliant on to one degree on the organization where that is in the life cycle, but the board members have a fiduciary responsibility. So you got the legal, the hiring and firing of the CEO, the financial piece, and then the delegation of a plan to the CEO, and the other piece that's so important is the skills we've mentioned of fundraising and being an ambassador. So if you're going to bring someone on board who does not feel comfortable being an ambassador and a fundraiser and, of course, a donor, then that's a challenge. So those would be the core skills and then the nuances of where that organization is, how sophisticated, what are the specific needs at that time might vary in terms of occupations and skills and specifics, but they've got to be able to make those tough decisions, to ensure that transparency, to make a gift and ask for a gift.
Great, thank you. And Sharon, I would recommend that you actually put together a job description for your board members, and search just as you would for a qualified staff person. We are almost out of time. Joe, what do you think if we cycle through everyone and have them give closing remarks to our audience of fundraisers and consultants on the line today? Words of wisdom to walk away with.
I think that makes total sense. Why don't we start with you, Dane?
I think today's conversation was great, and I would recommend for everyone on this line to have these conversations with people in your network. You don't have to come to a closing session like this to talk about hot topics and find out what's going on in other organizations. Look, you know, to your colleagues, your friends, your coworkers, people at other organizations that you aspire to be, and throw out these topics and have conversations with them. Could be really a helpful experience.
Tom, parting words of wisdom.
Be proud to ask people to contribute to your organization. Give them significance in their lives, and you're making a difference, and they are. And then parenthetically, on the board question, I like the idea that you're looking for wealth, wisdom, and work. And they got to have one or two of those, or you don't want them on your board. And you look at roles. Do you need an accountant? Do you need a lawyer? Do you need somebody who's expert in the program area of your work? Do you need somebody who's good at fundraising? You know, kind of really, I love the idea of a job description, and it's not for all board members, a job description for each one, because you want them to do different things.
That's right.
Okay, that's not a party. We didn't ask for a parting diatribe. Okay, moving along.
and I didn't ask for a parting shot, but that didn't stop you, Joe.
I love you, Tom. I'm just kidding. I love you, Tom. All right, Jeff, you have 45 seconds to tell us what everyone should be thinking over the next year.
just be sure you're engaging people in conversation, whether they're donors, volunteers, staff, board. Be dialoguing. Don't make it one way.
Very good. And Christina.
We live in the
moment. Oh, I'm sorry, Christina.
Oh, Christina.
My fault. Sorry, Christina.
No, it's okay. Just that I would keep the donor as number one. Remember that, you know, the donor is not going to care whether or not it's a development message, it's a fundraising message, it's an education message. Just keep that, what the donor needs to see and hear, be number one.
And mine would be we live in the most amazing time to be alive right now because we have so many different ways to connect with people in a really meaningful way that it's just an exciting time to be fundraisers.
Hear, hear.
How'd we do, Margaret? I think we might have 1 minute left.
Oh, is it my turn now? Oh, thanks so much. No, I think that was really awesome, and I was listening intently, and I don't know if everybody else heard this, but I think I heard y'all volunteer to do a follow-up session at some point in the near future because I know you have more ideas, and I know we didn't have enough time to cover everything. So trust me, I'll be following up with you on that.
Wow, you have really good hearing. I didn't hear that at all.
I know. I really do. I have super hearing.
It's the Pinot Noir. We'd love to, Margaret.
Well, I hope our attendees had as much fun and got as much out of this as we all did. On behalf of Fundraising Success Magazine and our editorial advisory board, I want to thank everyone for attending this session, and thank you so much for sticking around with us until the very end. It's not easy to get people to stick around for these closing sessions, so we really do appreciate you being here, and the staff of Fundraising Success really, really do appreciate our editorial advisory board members, so thank you. And attendees, if you missed any of today's sessions, you can view them at your convenience in the on-demand environment, which will be open for 3 months starting on Monday. Have a great evening, everyone, and thanks again for joining us.